Hello there. Today is August 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a disaster of epic proportions continues unfolding in the U.S. state of Texas.
We had over 17,000 people in 45 Red Cross and community shelters.
North Korea ramps up its rhetoric with fresh threats against the U.S.
No country should have missiles flying over them like those 130 million people in Japan.
Also ahead, how researchers are working to help adapt to climate change. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump and First Lady Melania flew to Texas on Tuesday for a firsthand look at the flood-ravaged state, even as Tropical Storm Harvey continues to dump heavy rain on the region. Trump told rescue officials in Corpus Christi, near where Harvey, then a powerful hurricane, first made landfall Friday, that he was very proud of their efforts to save lives and help people escape the massive flooding in the state.
We've pledged our full support as Texas and Louisiana battle and recover from this very devastating and historic storm. There's probably never been anything like this.
Highways have turned to rivers. Tens of thousands sought emergency shelter as Harvey continues to pound Texas. Countless numbers of people are still trapped as the storm makes landfall again. There are a number of fatalities reported, including a veteran Houston police officer who was on his way to work. The announcement came from Mayor Sylvester Turner.
Deeply saddened to announce the death of Sergeant Steve Perez. This is an individual who was with HPD, Houston Finest, men and women in blue, for 34 years. In fact, he was 2 days shy of his 61st birthday.
Thousands of people with no place to go are being sheltered in churches and convention centers, and they're coming with literally just the clothes on their backs. Joining me now is Greta Gustafson, spokesperson for the American Red Cross. Greta, thank you for being with us and for all you're doing. Tell us what you're dealing with.
So the Red Cross is working day and night to make sure to get help to where it is needed most. As of last night, we had over 17,000 people in 45 Red Cross and community shelters, and we do expect that number to rise as, you know, more people continue to seek refuge from this catastrophic storm. We have, along with our partners, served nearly 30,000 meals and snacks because, honestly, these people just really need a safe place to go. They need to have, you know, a nice meal and comfort, and that's what the Red Cross volunteers are making sure to do.
What are some of the things that you all are doing for these people at the shelters? What are their needs? I guess, if they're living there, pretty much sleeping, eating?
Our first priority with that is to make sure that we keep people safe. We're providing a safe place for them to be, a dry place for them to be. We're providing meals and also just a shoulder to lean on. We're providing them comfort and emotional support as well.
What are some of the things that you're hearing, seeing, any stories on the ground?
So really, one of our volunteers actually was heading into the shelter just to help another day, and she got a call from her husband that their house had flooded out, and so she had to turn back around and check and see if her family was safe, and make sure to get her kids and her husband to safety. And the next thing she did is she turned back around to go help out at the shelter again, because that's what our volunteers do. They're here to help the community because these are their neighbors, and they know what it feels like to lose everything, so they're wanting to help others who are in that same situation.
How long does the Red Cross plan on being there in Texas?
We'll be here as long as we're needed. It's hard to say at this point, but this isn't a disaster that's really measured in days. This is going to be weeks, months to come. So the Red Cross isn't going anywhere. We're here to make sure that this community recovers from this.
And are there enough places that are dry that can hold all these people? Because my understanding is a lot of these places are at capacity now.
So the Red Cross is really just making sure to bring people in and provide them a safe spot. We are working with community partners to see where else we can open safe shelters. But right now, our focus is just getting people into safety and making sure that we can get them out of the rain.
What happens in a situation where people are coming there with literally nothing but the clothes on their back and they've got no money, no clothing, may not even have their medication, things like that, the bare necessities? How do you deal with stuff like that?
We take people in, and that's what we're here to do, is provide them that safe place. When they don't have anywhere else to go and they have nothing else with them, we're going to make sure to wrap them in a blanket, get them dry clothes, as well as we do have health professionals there, too, to help refill any necessary prescriptions that they need and make sure to get them a meal and just a comfortable place to sit, because you're absolutely right. A lot of these people are leaving with nothing but the clothes on their back, just trying to get to safety, and that's what the Red Cross is trying to do. Is provide that safe place.
Obviously, you're used to dealing with disasters and people in need in disasters, but have you ever seen anything like what we're seeing here on this magnitude, this scale?
This is actually being called the worst flooding disaster in U.S. history right now. This is an incomparable disaster. This is a truly catastrophic event, and it's still raining, and it's going to be for a few days to come. So truly, every disaster is different, but this one is one of the most catastrophic, the most devastating that I've seen.
We appreciate all you're doing, and what can people do if they want to at least provide some sort of help or support?
So the best way to help is really through a financial donation. It's the best way to help provide that immediate disaster relief. So people can help by visiting redcross.org, calling 1-800-RED-CROSS, or texting the word Harvey to 90999 to make a $10 donation.
All right. Thanks so much again for all you're doing. Greta Gustafson with the American Red Cross. And by the way, the chief of the Federal Emergency Management Agency here in the U.S. warns that difficult times remain ahead, even when the rains finally end. A U.S. tropical storm record of more than 125 centimeters of rain have already fallen on southern Texas, with more on the way. And the historic storm and unprecedented rain and flooding continue. Tens of thousands have been displaced or are in danger. Many Texans, though, grabbed only their valuables, not only their valuables, but also their dogs and cats and other pets as they fled. After Hurricane Katrina in 2005, rescue officials have stressed the importance of evacuees bringing their pets because in New Orleans, some people refused to leave for fear of abandoning their animals. After that, authorities had to include pets in federal guidelines for disaster planning. And joining me now for this part of the story, Beth Gammy, Director of Field Services for Red Rover, a nonprofit organization that conducts emergency animal rescue disaster relief. And Beth, I understand you have volunteers deployed for this storm as well.
We are going to Dallas, Texas. Dallas is a host city for evacuees. So typically what happens in these big disasters is that cities outside the area end up being hosts for the evacuees. So many, many people have evacuated with their pets, and they are the city of Dallas is setting up a large mega shelter at the convention center to house up to 5,000 human evacuees. And so we're going to be helping the SPCA of Texas help take care of the animals that show up with their humans.
Okay. And what about animals that may be stranded and in need of rescue? Are you guys also dealing with anything like that?
We may be taking care of those animals. We're not going to be the ones going out in the field and doing the rescues. But if those, you know, all the area down by the flooding, you know, is totally destroyed, and they have very little capacity. So I know that that we might be taking care of about 123 cats rescued from Corpus Christi. So sometimes rescued animals from the flood areas get transported outside of the impacted area to shelters that can have the capacity to take care of them.
I would imagine that given the magnitude of what's happening there, that the shelters are possibly also underwater?
Sure. Yeah, we've been just hearing really kind of heartbreaking stories about flooding and destruction all along the coast there. And I think that the full impact of what's happened won't be known for days to come. What has been happening in the last couple of years in emergency animal response is that shelters have been getting better and better at reaching out to groups to kind of empty their shelters in anticipation of a disaster like this so that, one, those animals are safe, and two, they have more space to take in rescued animals in their area. You know, when we have a notice event like this, like a hurricane where you do have days of notice, I'm just aware of groups working at offering to shelters, hey, if you need transport of your animals out, we can help you with it. They can go to these other places, and then that frees them up to take in storm animals in their own area.
It's also good for people to know that if they are having to go to one of the Red Cross shelters or to the convention center, that they are allowed to bring their pets.
It's just huge because any animal lover will tell you that, you know, their pets are part of their family. And people shouldn't have to leave part of their family behind. And we've really just worked so hard at kind of raising people's consciousness that, you know, if it's not safe for you to stay, it's not safe for your pet. You know, the human disaster management side is realizing that, you know, your humans are putting their lives at risk by not evacuating if they can't take their pets. So, you know, the whole movement is to really just make pet sheltering standard part of human mass sheltering so people do leave and they do keep the family together.
All right. Well, we appreciate it. Beth Gammy, Director of Field Services for Red Rover, an organization conducting emergency animal rescue. Here are some of the stories. We're following at voanews.com. The U.S. Attorney General says the opioid crisis is America's top lethal issue. The Islamic State is becoming a growing presence in Southeast Asia. Al-Shabaab defectors are being rehabilitated to re-enter Somali society. And pizza delivery without drivers. Domino's and Ford team up for a test. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, North Korea acknowledges firing a ballistic missile over Japan, saying it was to counter current joint military exercises by South Korea and the United States. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley spoke during an emergency session of the U.N. Security Council Tuesday evening following Pyongyang's missile launch.
We are all demanding North Korea stop any future missile launches. We are all demanding North Korea abandon its nuclear weapons. North Korea has violated every single Security Council resolution and violated international law.
And the council condemning in the strongest terms North Korea's actions. President Trump earlier Tuesday in a statement said all options are on the table. U.S. officials say the missile didn't pose any threat to North America or to the U.S. Pacific Island territory of Guam, which North Korea has threatened in the past. Still, the launch heightened concerns about the increasingly rapid pace of the North Korean missile program. Joining me now to discuss is Dr. Bill Parker, COO with the East-West Institute. Thanks for being with us. So what is happening here?
First of all, Kim Jong-un is miscalculating the seriousness of his actions and where that could end up. I think he's not taking the statement from President Trump seriously that all options are on the table, and I assume that includes military options. And while they have a missile capability and they have some nuclear capability, they are still the 25th military ranked in the world, and they're insignificant compared to the rest of the world, and I think they have missed that bigger picture.
Do you think that they're focusing too much on their nuclear program? And what do you think is going on domestically there? Does this somehow relate to that?
it always relates back to everything is local, politics are local. But at the end of the day, nuclear weapons are considered to be the great equalizers. And so when you look at countries like Pakistan, Iran, North Korea, they have conventional means that are considered lightweight military. They're suddenly considered serious threats due to their ability to inflict large numbers of casualties with one weapon. So in a roundabout way, a nuclear weapon capability can lead to a more powerful nation like the United States being drug into negotiations and onto the table of negotiations with those nations that would otherwise be considered lightweight.
Do you think that North Korea is getting closer and closer to having some sort of missile or nuclear weapon actually reach parts of the Western U.S.?
I do believe that. When you look at the capability as it's ramped up really since 1994, that has continued to increase. The range of the missiles has continued to increase. And when you look at the fact that they're trying to miniaturize their nuclear warheads, that they've tested submarine-launched ballistic missiles, I think that's a major threat. But the other threat that isn't talked about much is the fact that even without the missile capability, if they have the ability, and they've already proven this, to detonate a nuclear weapon, then certainly they have the ability to detonate that where they want to as long as they can deliver it, whether that's in a truck, a car, or in some kind of ship or airplane or something else. So it doesn't always have to be delivered by a missile.
How concerned are you by Kim Jong-un's actions, and do you think that he's likely to do something that would be horrific?
I am concerned about it at this point. He has not gotten the message. That's pretty clear. I was not as concerned 3 or 4 months ago. I thought he would start backing off as the rest of the world basically said, you need to knock this off. Mm-hmm. He hasn't done that. As a matter of fact, he's been ramping up, especially in the last couple of days in particular, which tells me he believes his own rhetoric. I believe that you will see him continue that until something significant is done to stop his activities at this time.
What is that significant thing? What can be done?
I think that we will continue with even tougher sanctions, if that's possible, to include imports and exports. And I think the conversation about a military action is going to be more and more serious by the day to include moving more forces in that area.
How could we possibly take military action without millions of people be killed? I mean, it would seem like there would be mass fatalities.
The United States military has the best strategic planners in the world, no doubt about that. And this is something they've been thinking about for decades now. They have the right people thinking through these issues with people in the National Security Council and others to be able to take the proper actions. You can see that there are discussions going on between the United States and China, between the United States and South Korea, between the United States and Japan. So any kind of action will undoubtedly include those other countries in one way or the other. I do not see this being a unilateral activity by the United States. I do not think that you will see a unilateral strike by the United States. That said, if the other countries do nothing about it and there continues to show both, remember, threat is both intent and capability. Mm-hmm. They have stated over and over again through Kim Jong-un's rhetoric that he has the intent to harm the United States or its people. Now he's starting to get that capability that's increasing day by day. So that means the threat continues to increase and it's becoming more and more real every day. If it gets to the point where the only action that can be taken is the United States to operate unilaterally, I believe this president would take that action.
How concerned are you that we are likely heading to a war with North Korea?
I'm not sure likely is the right term, but possibly is maybe a better term. And I am concerned. I am concerned because anytime you're talking about weapons of mass destruction, whether chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, high yield explosives, you're talking about the potential high loss of life. So that concerns me. On the other side, if you do nothing like we've been doing really since 1991, certainly 1994, that concerns me even more, that we continue to allow this capability to grow in the hands of a madman. And if we continue to allow that to happen, the threat is going to continue to grow and grow until the point that we will have to do something even more significant.
All right, Bill Parker, Dr. Bill Parker, COO of the East-West Institute, thanks for your time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, there are two ways to deal with climate change: stop or slow it through controlling emissions, or adapt to it. Chances are we're going to have to do both in the next 80 years. In the dry areas of Texas and California, researchers are already getting started on the adapting part. VOA's Kevin Enix reports.
When people think of climate change, they often think of a future with extreme storms, bringing too much water. But scientists in Texas and California are planning for a future with a lot less. USC professor Sarah Feakins spoke to VOA by Skype.
It's always a challenge having enough water for plants to grow, and especially in dry years. So that's the motivation behind trying to figure out if we can develop crops that are more resilient to drought.
Feakins says higher temperatures mean higher rates of evaporation, and that means potentially less water for everyone. So the research team began planting crops and not giving them enough water.
So here we're looking at these wheat varieties, and they have been bred. They've been bred over sort of about 10 years, selecting for traits that mean that they will grow well in the dry conditions of Texas. And so we're simply seeing which of these 10 cultivars perform better in dry conditions, in the different sites, the different soils, and the different climates.
What Feakins and her team learned is that when things get hot or plants get deprived of water, they produce more of the natural wax that coats their leaves. The more wax on the leaves, the more water stays in the plant.
So at the higher and drier location, when we grow the same crops, 10 different cultivars, all of them produce more wax. It's a little bit like on a dry day, you know, you might put some lip balm on your lips. Plants actually put more wax on the surface of their leaves at the drier location.
The team was able to grow bountiful crops with 25% less water, and they learned one other surprising thing. The wax that coats plant leaves also holds carbon.
If we could double the waxiness of plants, it might actually help sequester carbon in the soils.
That's an added bonus in a future that will likely have too much carbon and not enough water. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Well, a new film from award-winning director Francis Lee, God's Own Country, explores the dynamics of a homosexual relationship between a farmer's son and a Romanian stranger who comes to work for him. VOA's David Byrd has a story.
God's Own Country tells the story of young farmer Johnny Saxby, played by Josh O'Connor, whose life consists of getting drunk, having casual sex, and keeping the family farm going after his father has a stroke and his grandmother is too old to help. Johnny is forced to confront his true feelings when a Romanian migrant worker, Gheorghe Ionescu, played by Alex Securanu, comes to work on the farm during lambing season. God's Own Country has been called the Yorkshire Brokeback Mountain, but writer-director Francis Lee says, unlike that multiple Oscar-winning film, it's not a cultural taboo, but the characters' own emotional limitations that prevent them from expressing their true feelings.
Where Brokeback Mountain, the two central characters can't be together because of society, because of a certain amount of homophobia that's going on, whereas in God's Own Country, the thing that prevents the characters being together is themselves emotionally, not being able to open up. So they're not governed by, if you like, circumstances. It's not issue-based.
Josh O'Connor says that God's Own Country ends on a more hopeful note than Brokeback.
I do think that it's a very different
similar surroundings, similar themes, but actually very different experience. And the relationship between the two men in Brokeback Mountain is quite a damaging one, whereas this is very hopeful and a positive relationship. Mm-hmm.
To ensure authenticity, the lead actors worked on a farm to learn the language and the techniques needed. Josh O'Connor says the work was necessary to help make this film believable.
Yeah. So all the farming you see in the film, like Alex skins a lamb, and Alec delivers a lamb. Alec does a lot. I inspect a cow. They're all totally real, and that was really important for us and to us was the authenticity of that world.
Alex Sekaranu says the training helped when working with animals who had minds of their own.
And as an actor, I think it's very important for us to feel comfortable around animals, because we really had to do a lot of stuff with animals and we had to control them, and it's very hard to work with animals because they are very unpredictable. And I think we did a pretty good job with them, yeah.
God's Own Country also features several graphic sex scenes between the lead characters. Director Francis Lee says he thinks the sex was needed for the character's development.
Absolutely. I think if it informs the characters and where they're at emotionally, and you can show how they communicate through sex, and you can also show how they change by how they communicate in sex, then I think it's a very, very powerful storytelling tool.
God's Own Country won the directing award at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It also won awards at festivals in Berlin, Edinburgh, Galway, San Francisco, and Toronto. It opens in U.S. theaters October 27th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jim Harmon. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States welcome the recent announcement by the Libyan National Army, or LNA, that it will investigate reports of unlawful killings in Benghazi. The LNA has recognized the arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court prosecutor for a member of the LNA, Major Mahmoud Mustafa Bouseif Al-Werfali, and has suspended him pending an investigation. The United States calls on the LNA to ensure that the investigation is carried out fully and fairly, and those responsible for the unlawful killings are held to account. Al-Werfali, a senior Libyan military commander, stands accused by the International Criminal Tribunal judges of personally shooting or ordering the execution of 33 people who were either civilians or injured fighters in at least 7 incidents in 2016 and 2017. Major Al-Werfali is loyal to strongman Khalifa Haftar, a former general under longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Haftar heads the most powerful military in Libya, and his forces recently managed to retake Benghazi after a 3-year campaign against other militant groups. The U.S. is monitoring ongoing acts of conflict in Libya closely. Those suspected of committing, ordering, or failing to prevent unlawful killings and torture on all sides must be fully investigated and held accountable. The U.S. and its allies will continue efforts at the international level to pursue appropriate action against those who are complicit in violations of international human rights law or international humanitarian law, whatever their affiliation. It is in Libya's interest to be able to rely on unified security forces responsible for the country's security and acting within the framework of Libya's laws and respecting international law. The governments of France, the United Kingdom, and the United States also reaffirm their support for the Government of National Accord. We underscore the importance of the United Nations' central role in facilitating Libyan-led political dialogue, welcome the appointment of the new special representative of the Secretary General, Ghassan Salamé, and look forward to supporting his efforts to facilitate a political solution in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.